Senate and House State Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:36 p.m. on February 13th. We're meeting today in room 106 in the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Senate present committee members are Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Giesel, Senator Begich, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Wilson. House Chair Sponholz, would you like to please introduce your members today?
House members present are Representative Sam Keto and myself, Representative Sponholz.
Today we will hear from Dr. Joshua Sunkiss on the science of opioid addiction. Dr. Sunkiss is a board-certified psychiatrist with a wide range of experience in practicing in Alaska. He will be discussing the biological basis of opioid addiction in order to understand the unique vulnerabilities of the needs of patients with opioid disorders, including the reward circuit, tolerance, withdrawal, dependence of addiction. And before we begin, we have Rep. Johnston joining us today. Thank you, Doctor. And for committee members, Dr. Sunkiss has a lot of information to cover, so we're just going to just refrain from asking a lot of in-depth technical questions, but just for informational, for understanding, please feel free to stop him for questions for clarification of information that he's presenting. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. So, I went to a talk the other night, and the speaker spoke for 20 minutes before anyone told him that we couldn't hear him. So please let me know if you can't hear me. I'm Joshua Sunkiss, MD, Chief Medical Officer of Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. And I want to thank you for inviting me here today. And I also really appreciate the weather that you ordered up for me, and so does my dry cleaner. We're going to be talking about the science of opioid use disorder, and I always start a talk by making a disclosure statement. I don't have any financial relationships with any pharmaceutical companies at all, so that's not something that colors kind of my professional opinion of the topics that I'm talking about today. There are some learning objectives in your slides that are really for if you were getting a continuing education credit for this, but they're just a helpful guide to what I'm going to talk about. As far as what I am going to cover today, talk a little bit about a review of addiction in general, and then I'm going to dive into the neuroanatomy of the reward circuit that's very important in addiction. We'll talk about two models of cognitive impairment in addiction. The importance of that is that cognitive impairment in addiction is one of the reasons why addiction is so pernicious and difficult to treat. I'll talk about research on executive functioning in addiction, and I'll try to make it interesting for everyone, because my number one goal is to keep all of you awake. And then I'll talk about evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder that I hope will help all of you make informed policy decisions around opioid use disorder treatment. Brief review of addiction. You need four things to have addiction, and here they are. The first one is tolerance. The second is withdrawal. The third is dependence, and then you need a little something more. Now, I know some of you are health professionals and have some familiarity with these concepts, but let me talk about them each in a little more detail. So tolerance is the need to take more of a drug to get the same effect. Now, usually I start off talks like this with a joke or two, and I think you guys are kind of a tough audience. But in general, what I find is that I get some good laughs early on, but over the course of the presentation, if my jokes don't get continually better, the audience response falls off, and that's tolerance. Okay, you need more of something in order to get the same response that you had before. And with drugs, you can start off, you get a good buzz from one drink, or you get a nice, relaxed feeling from one oxycodone tablet, but after a while, you build up a tolerance, and you need more and more and more. So that's tolerance. That's part number one, the first ingredient of addiction. What causes tolerance? I think it's important to go a little bit into the details here. What happens is that the brain makes adjustments so that it functions normally when the drug is present, and it and abnormally when it's not. Now, if you think about driving with your brakes on, if you think of drugs, like let's say heroin. Heroin is like a big, heavy, leaden foot on the brake pedal. All right, and we'll talk about the neuroanatomy of that in a minute. But the idea is that the more you push on the brake with the heroin, the harder you have to push on the gas to get up to highway speed, or let's say to stay awake, or to stay breathing, or to stay alive. Okay, that's the purpose of tolerance, really, is it's your body adapting to the drug. And the harder you push on the gas, the harder you have to push on the brake to stay under the speed limit. There are several different mechanisms of tolerance, and I'm not going to go into too much detail on all of them. There's some really technical things like DNA methylation. There are some elaborate metabolic pathways that I don't think we need to go into. One of the big ways that it's important to know about is downregulation of receptors. So the way that neurons communicate with each other in your brain is pretty interesting. One cell will send an electrical signal from one end down to the other end, but then it stops. And then you got a dude standing there with a ball who throws it across this place called the synapse. I could throw a ball to Senator Wilson right now, and he'd catch it if it's the right kind of a ball. And that ball is a neurotransmitter. If he catches it, he's going to flip a switch and send an electrical current down to the other end of his neuron, the next neuron. Okay. Now, if you look at the three cells here on the current slide, it's really the same cell over time. And you'll see some little orangey-yellow dots floating around. Let's call those morphine, one of the active ingredients in heroin, active metabolites of heroin. And that cell needs to have some dopamine receptors that are occupied at all times. Those red things stuck in the cell membrane, those are dopamine receptors, opioid receptors. I misspoke, that's an opioid receptor. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that this cell needs to have two opioid receptors full at any given time in order to operate the way that it's supposed to. Okay. Now, you can see in this first cell that it's kind of flooded with morphine. And so, consequently, this cell has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 receptors occupied. That's too many. So this is a cell that's not functioning well. It's overwhelmed with morphine. And so what is it going to do to adjust? Well, it's going to start taking down the mailboxes, right? I'm kind of mixing metaphors, but it's going to start taking down the receptors that these morphine molecules plug into until it gets down in the third cell there. It only has two receptors left, and there's so much morphine floating around that they're full all the time. Those two receptors are full all the time. And now this cell can function the way it's supposed to function. Now, if you imagine if you suddenly took away all those morphine molecules from a cell that now only has two opioid receptors, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to get withdrawal, right? Because now there's not enough opioid receptors left to have two full all the time. So when you get withdrawal, that's really what's happening, is your body has adjusted so much, has developed so much tolerance to a substance that when you take it away, you get a whole bunch of awful physiological symptoms. And this is a clinical opioid withdrawal scale. It's a scale that doctors and others use to kind of objectively measure opioid withdrawal in clinical settings, to try to detox someone. This is how we can objectively measure how severe someone's withdrawal is. For some substances, withdrawal can be deadly. Alcohol is a number one example. With opioids, it usually isn't. It sometimes can be. But the idea is that you get a really pronounced physiological response when you take away the substance of tolerance. Now, this brings us to dependence. When you have tolerance plus withdrawal, you have dependence. Okay, so dependence is not its own thing. It's just a combination of the first two things. Now, I'll stop here for a minute, because anybody in this room could get into a motor vehicle accident later today. I hope nobody does. But it could happen, and you could wake up in a week on the orthopedic ward with a bunch of plates and screws, and you could find yourselves dependent on morphine. Probably take longer than a week. But that could happen to anybody here. You could become dependent on morphine in a healthcare emergency. Does that make you an addict? No one can answer because I'm the one giving testimony. But the correct answer is no. Okay, it takes more than just dependence to have addiction. And that brings us to the fourth thing. I'll talk a little bit about this slide. I'm going to give a couple of examples of medicines in general medicine and in psychiatry that can cause tolerance and withdrawal that aren't really substances of abuse, but they do have withdrawal syndrome. So clonidine is a blood pressure medicine that's not used very much anymore, but there are a few refractory cases around that still get prescribed clonidine, and it works really, really well. But everybody forgets to take their medicine, and when you forget to take clonidine, what happens is you get rebound hypertension. And so what that means is that your blood pressure not only goes back up to as high as it was before, but it overshoots and it goes much higher, even to the point of danger. Okay, so there is a dependence that develops to clonidine, but none of my patients ever get addicted to their blood pressure medicines. I mean, if they did, I could call myself a much better doctor, but nobody wants to take their blood pressure medicine. Another example is venlafaxine is a very common antidepressant medicine. You'll notice I'm using the generic names here. Venlafaxine has a really pronounced withdrawal syndrome. If a patient who takes it for depression forgets to take it for a day, they'll very quickly feel like they have the flu. And by day three, they want to come and strangle me. So that medicine has a withdrawal syndrome, but nobody gets addicted to it. Nobody builds a criminal lifestyle to try to get their hands on this antidepressant medicine. All right? You have to have the fourth thing. So what is it? Well, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and I think this is a pretty good definition, addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disease characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use, despite harmful consequences. So that fourth ingredient is crucial. You have to have the despite adverse consequences, whether it's getting a DUI, going to jail, having OCS come in and take your children away, or any of a large number of other adverse consequences. If you continue seeking a substance despite adverse consequences, then we're getting into addiction territory. I should mention that experts in the field are using the word addiction less and less. Just so you know, we talk about substance use disorders less than addiction these days, but I'm going to continue to use the word addiction because then we all know what we're talking about. I'd like to review briefly some models of addiction that we often invoke and talk about and use and apply, especially in policy settings, sometimes without thinking about them completely as kind of models. So let me just kind of go through a few. There's the moral model that I think we're all familiar with, and basically what it says is if you're addicted to drugs or alcohol, you're just weak, you're a weak person, all right? There may be some circumstances, much as I hate to admit it, where that might actually be an appropriate model to apply. If you have a son or a daughter who's dating a drug dealer, you might want to invoke that model. I don't know that it would work, but you could. It's out there. People use it all the time. The criminal model is another one. We've got the war on drugs. If you are a police officer, I don't know who's in the audience behind me, but if there's a police officer or a prosecutor or someone involved in the legal system, the criminal model might be a really good model to invoke. The recovery model really speaks to a personal journey through addiction. And then the social model has to do with the role of trauma in causing susceptibility to addiction and things of that nature. And then there's the medical model. And of course, I'm a medical doctor, and I'm really here primarily to talk about addiction as a disease, really. The take-home point for this slide that I hope you'll remember is that these are perspectives on addiction. They're not mutually exclusive. And even the weak character model has, interestingly, some potential biological underpinnings that I'll talk about in a little while. All right. So there's no supremacy of the medical model, but what I will say is the scientific basis of these models increases as you move down the list. We have more scientific evidence to support the medical model than some of the others. All right, now let's talk about how addiction gets started and how addiction gets sustained. Fundamentally, addiction gets started by an overdose of dopamine. Dopamine is not a drug. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that we all have, and it's the fundamental neurotransmitter of pleasure and reward. And every time any of us does anything that is simultaneously good for us and pleasurable, we get a burst of dopamine. So eating lunch, dopamine. Seeing a friend, greeting a friend in the hallway, dopamine. Having sex, dopamine. Getting promoted, dopamine. You get the picture, all right? Now, look at the actual picture on the slide, and what you'll see is you'll see two neurons. I'm going to kind of try to explain how this works. I already explained how I could toss a ball across a synapse, so what you're seeing is a picture of that exact thing. On top, there's an upstream cell, and on the bottom is a downstream cell. On the top, the upstream cell wants to communicate something to the bottom, the downstream cell, using dopamine as a neurotransmitter. So on the left side, we have someone who had a tasty meal and gets a little burst of dopamine going across the synapse, and they experience pleasure. And what does that do? Well, it reinforces the behavior of eating. Okay, this is basic behavioral psychology happening right at the synaptic level. If we didn't find food pleasurable, we wouldn't eat, and then pretty soon, well, you know, we wouldn't be here anymore. Now, you'll see that there's not a whole lot of dopamine molecules in that synapse, but that's fine. You don't need very many to reinforce good behaviors. On the right side, what we have here is a massive flood of dopamine when somebody takes cocaine. Now, I'm here to talk about opioids, and this slide shows cocaine. But it doesn't matter, because in every substance use disorder, a flood of dopamine is really what gets things started. Okay. And pretty quickly what happens, first of all, a person who takes cocaine, they feel super duper amazingly awesome. Complete euphoria, best feeling they've ever experienced. And memories of that are very quickly ingrained in different parts of your brain. And that downstream cell pretty quickly has to start taking down receptors, just like I talked about a few minutes ago. I hope you're with me so far. If anybody does need a clarification for anything, please.
Yeah, Senator Machiki?
Are you? Would you rather we wait till the end for questions?
Clarifying question, please.
I have one actually on the slide back, slide 15. One more. Just curious, and I support that addiction is a medical condition, but is it the only relatively voluntary disease that you can think of?
Answering Senator Mikish through the chair. No. I would say a couple of things. One, the voluntary stage of addiction is the very early stage, and really it's the stage that I just talked about where you get a dopamine rush. Very quickly after that, the voluntariness of the disease becomes less and less voluntary. Are there other diseases that have a voluntary component? Absolutely. I think the number one that comes to my mind is diabetes mellitus, non-insulin dependent, so-called type 2 diabetes, that is really largely a lifestyle disease, but in a public health, public policy kind of a setting. We certainly can blame that on the individual patient, but it doesn't help the population. So that'd be the number one. I think STIs, sexually transmitted infections, would be another good example.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what sustains addiction as we start to move away from that voluntary, I'll try that cocaine, I get a flood of dopamine. Why do I keep going after that? That's what I'm talking about here. Largely, it's a conditioning based on memories of that intense pleasure. Now, most of us think of memory as a story that we can tell about something that happened to us. But much of what we learn has nothing to do with what we can articulate to people or explain to people or paint a picture of to people. It has to do with behaviors that are ingrained and associated with something that we experienced in the past. In this case, something that we experienced is very pleasurable. So when you think about conditioning based on memories of intense pleasure, you really want to think not about your school teacher, but about Pavlov's dogs. This is a picture of one of Pavlov's actual dogs. And the poor thing is going to salivate when the light bulb comes on, no matter what. Now, you can explain to this dog that it's morally wrong to salivate when the light comes on. You can yell at the dog, kick the dog, electrocute the dog. But once this dog has been conditioned to respond to that light bulb going on, it's going to salivate no matter what. It's very difficult to take the salivation out of a dog. Now, people are a lot more complex than dogs, but this is the kind of learning that I'm talking about. Another key point on the kind of sustaining of addiction is the idea of salience. And I'll talk more about salience. Salience of drugs eclipses other stimuli for the addict. So what that means is that drugs are right there in the foreground all the time. And even natural consequences like, again, you know, getting arrested, drugs still remain more important for many addicts. And to illustrate that, before I talk any more about salience, let me draw your attention. What did all of you notice about this pepper up here in the upper left-hand corner? I know none of you can answer, but the obvious answer and the correct one, of course, is nothing. You didn't notice that one. You noticed the big red one. Why? Because the red is a salient color for us, so we all look immediately at the red pepper. So I only put that there to explain the concept of salience. Now let me bring this into an addiction context. Salience in a healthy brain. Now, many of you have families. I have a family. And my family, to me, is the most important thing in the world. Okay, it's very salient. And every decision that I make has at least some relationship to the well-being of my wife and my son. And in a healthy brain, that's what salience looks like. There's other things that are salient. You know, coming here today, making sure I got here on time, making sure I was appropriately dressed, and all those things. So, but drugs, you know, I know drugs are out there, but they're not salient for me. They're way in the background. Not really thinking about drugs. Not really thinking about alcohol. But for an addict who may start out right here after the drug gets its grip, and this comes around to an earlier clarification question. Once the drug gets its grip, you'll find addicts evolving more and more towards this. And there are very specific neurobiological processes that underlie the process of getting from here to here, and of course there's lots of space in between. But when you have a really severe addiction, the salience of drugs is paramount. It eclipses everything else. And interestingly, you can visualize that on a brain scan that I'll show you a little bit later. Now, I want to talk a little bit about kind of the circuit board of the brain here. And this is kind of a classic picture of the reward circuit. And the reward, your brain is much more complex than just these four structures that are shown, but every addiction, including opioid addiction, runs between these four structures. Involves others, but these are really key, and then especially the three that are on the right. On the top on the right, and you can point your finger at your forehead about an inch above your eyes, and you'll point out right where your PFC, prefrontal cortex is. It's just right behind your forehead, and it's the part of your brain that makes you who you are. It's responsible for your judgment and your thinking and your reasoning and your decision making and all of the things that all of the qualities that enable you not only to have the personality that you have, but also to hold the positions of high responsibility that you have. Okay, all of you have wonderfully functioning prefrontal cortices, or you wouldn't be here today. Now, just below that, you have the nucleus accumbens, and it does a lot of things, but I want to emphasize today its role in pleasure. When you feel pleasure, that's really kind of where you feel it in your brain. And it communicates with the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is up there saying, hey, I don't want you running around trying to feel pleasure all the time. And the nucleus accumbens is saying, oh, man, this feels really good. We've got to do more of this. So there's a little bit of an interplay between those two structures. Now, I'm going to move down to the next one to the left is the ventral tegmental area, or VTA. And that is the seat of the seat of reward. And so you can think of the VTA as kind of an internal dog trainer, that when you do something good, like again, accomplish, let's say you accomplish something, all right, you accomplish something, and the VTA will send some dopamine through a long nerve cell body up to the nucleus accumbens, which will then feel awesome, and it will tell your prefrontal cortex, this is something that you should let me do, okay? Now, just to describe this last structure here, the locus coeruleus. The locus coeruleus is, the main job of it is to keep you awake and alert and paying attention. And I just want to touch on this because it's very important for the side effects of nervous system depressants like opioids and alcohol, and it's also really important for withdrawal. So when I talked earlier about drugs kind of pushing on the brakes, the locus coeruleus is one of the primary structures that is getting having its brakes pushed on. All right, and so when you if you take opioids, if you're addicted to opioids, and you're escalating your use and pushing on the brake and trying to shut down that locus coeruleus, you know, what do you see with someone who's intoxicated with opioids? They're kind of sleepy, kind of out of it, and then the locus coeruleus has to crank up the gas harder and harder in order to keep you awake and alert and paying attention and alive. So if you overdose on heroin, this is one of the structures that shuts down, all right? And then, you know, you could die. If you go into withdrawal from opioids, then this structure now is pushing the pedal to the metal on the gas. You take away the opioids, and of course you get a massive adrenergic or noradrenergic rush. And in fact, that's the main neurotransmitter in the locus coeruleus is norepinephrine. And I know all of you know about norepinephrine because you all had to take a plane to get into Juneau.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Majicki.
Just a little tiny bit, I don't know about confused, but is a person with a substance abuse problem, are they addicted to opioids or are they addicted to dopamine distribution?
Okay, so in response to Senator Mikish through the chair, that's a great question. There are many people, many experts who will say that that dopamine is the main, dopamine is in fact the main mediator of addiction. And so when you have addiction, what happens is that you end up with a dopamine deficiency. And I'll get into this a little bit more later in the talk, but the idea is that when you take down all of those opioid receptors like I talked about before, you're also taking down dopamine receptors, okay? You're down-regulating receptors. And so what ends up happening is that regular stuff like going to the school play doesn't do it for you anymore. Only your drug of abuse gets you enough dopamine to be able to get that rush. And when I say rush, I mean really just a small rush. Like you might be experiencing right now as I'm answering your question, you're getting a certain sense of, hopefully, satisfaction that you're question is being answered. Dopamine is involved in that. But for someone who's addicted, that's not going to do it for them. Great question.
Chair Sponholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, so you've been talking specifically, Dr. Sankis, about opioids, but is this process similar for other addictions?
So answering through the chair, this process is essentially the same for all addictive substances, and in fact, for some behaviors that are addictive, even though they don't involve substances. So, for example, compulsive pornography use would be a really good example, or compulsive gambling would be another really good example. And the reason is, again, the neural circuitry is the same for all of these substances and behaviors, and the deficit in dopamine is fundamental to all of these substances and behaviors.
Thank you. I asked the question because I think that it's important that we understand that that this is the same problem that we run into with with alcohol and other kinds of drugs that are actually far more prevalent than opioids in the state. Thanks.
So this is probably a good place to mention that, you know, there are fundamental differences between different substances of abuse. So even though we're using the same general circuits, the general concepts are the same, there are some key differences, and one of them with opioid use disorder is that the down, you remember I talked about the down regulation of receptors. Well, you can detox someone and they'll start upregulating those receptors again, but the extent to which brain changes can be reversed is not the same for every person, and it's not the same for every substance. And opioids, with opioids, that reversal is much more difficult to achieve, and many people never achieve it. Whereas with other substances like alcohol, for most people, it is easier to achieve. Okay, I'm going to skip through these slides because I think we've covered this material with the diagram. I'm going to talk about, I talked about the biomedical model of addiction, but really there are several different models, and mostly they're complementary. They're not competitive. I'm going to talk briefly about two that I think will be really easy to grasp, and I think you'll all have an intuitive understanding of what they're about. So first is the changed set point. And the idea here is that really any drug use, but with opioids, the changes are mostly permanent or semi-permanent. Opioid use or drug use causes permanent structural and chemical changes that create a new biological and behavioral baseline for the addict. And the reason I think this will be familiar to many of you is that, you know, if you've ever tried to lose weight, set point becomes really obvious. You know, your body wants to be at a certain weight. If you gain weight at some point in your life and then you want to lose it, it's hard because now that's where your body wants to be. And you might be able to lose it for a while, but almost inevitably it'll come back and then some. So very intuitive and really important for addiction is just this idea that once you have some neurobiological changes occur in the setting of addiction, they can be reversed somewhat, but mostly they just really want to sit there. And that's a big part of the challenge, and it's a big part of why treatment can be difficult and why relapse is so common, especially with opioids. The other model, and I think this really speaks directly to Senator Mikish's earlier question about voluntariness, is that the cognitive deficits model says, in essence, that drug use, and particularly opioid use, degrades prefrontal cortical inhibition of the drive to use, and it undermines the addict's will at a neurologic level. So there really is some truth to the idea that a person who's addicted, they really do lack some will, and this is the reason. It's because the prefrontal cortex is almost, you can think of it like your inner parent. And the inner parent, I mean, we've all known parents who didn't have very disciplined children. And in addiction, the prefrontal cortex becomes a less and less effective parent to the other parts of the brain that drive emotional responses and behaviors. So this is my very rudimentary slide showing this model. And, you know, of course, it's not that simple. You know, addiction is very, very pervasive, and many people with addiction are very, very highly functioning, many of them in recovery, but even many who are not in recovery. And that's because, you know, you can compensate to a large extent. But when we start looking at opioid addiction, it becomes more and more difficult to compensate. The more severe addiction, becomes, the more difficult it is to compensate. The more undermined the will becomes, and the less effective the prefrontal cortex becomes. Let me check how I'm doing on time. I'm just going to break down the cognitive impairment that occurs in addiction into some interesting categories. because when we talk about the will being undermined, you know, what does that look like? Well, here's what it looks like. Domains of impairment, impulsivity. I think we're all familiar with that. We're in Juneau. This is a political setting. We all need to exercise impulse control. You don't want to say the wrong thing. We're all very familiar with that. But there are people who act before thinking or speak before thinking. That's impulsivity. And people who use drugs to excess tend to be more impulsive to start with, and they tend to become more impulsive over time. So that's one big area of impairment. Reward hypersensitivity is another one. And all that really means is that you really, really want something. I mean, you really want it. And you're likely to, if I really wanted a piece of candy, you know, I might just, I know somebody out in the hallway has some candy, I just think up an excuse and I'll go because it's more important to me than what I'm doing here. Okay, that's the idea. Harm hyposensitivity would be, they're probably not going to think very highly of me if I go out in the hallway to get a piece of candy, but I don't really care about that. Okay. Increased risk-taking. I might sneak into the bathroom and eat candy. They're probably never going to find out, you know. Or maybe really a more realistic example is I'm on probation. I'm in trouble with OCS. They've got custody of my kids. But I'm going to go sneak away and use on Saturday night anyway because they're probably not going to urine test me on Monday morning. I mean, they might, but they probably won't. Okay. So just take more risks. And then there's this idea of outcome myopia, which I think is really fascinating. The example I use with an audience that I can be more interactive with is I say, well, would you rather have me give you $5 or $10? And, of course, everybody says $10. And then I say, well, would you rather have me give you $5 now or $10 tomorrow when I'm going to be back in Anchorage? And then they say they'll go for the $5. So outcome myopia is this idea that getting high now is more important to me than getting a job in a month or getting my kids back in 6 months because it's now. It's worth more to me because it's now. And the same idea applies inversely, that a punishment is less important to me if it's out in the future. Okay, so if I'm going to get an electric shock right now for picking up a drink of alcohol, then I'm probably not going to touch it. But if you tell me, you know, in 6 months you're going to get an electric shock, I'll probably take a drink. So that's the idea. And those are the ways, some of the ways, that your prefrontal cortical inhibition of addictive behavior can be undermined by the addiction itself. Some of you might be sitting there thinking, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, how do you know this? Didn't you just make all this stuff up? Well, no. I'll show you four categories of research that support these theories. One is self-report, which is basically just you telling someone how you feel or what you do, all right? Just like a political canvas. Behavioral tasks. Those are psychological tests, in essence. Computational modeling is taking a computer program to evaluate psychological tests in more detail. And then the final and most fun of them all is neuroimaging. So self-report tests, we all know that they're deeply flawed because we never know if people are answering honestly, for example. But in this, addicts know that they're more impulsive than other people. And this is a really good example of a study that shows that. So this is a test called the Barrett Impulsivity Scale, and I don't know any of the questions on it, and they don't really matter. The idea is that it's a pretty good measure as a self-report. People fill it out, and then you can see what their score is, and then you can look at the kind of lives they lead and say, oh, yeah, I can see the correlation there. This person's less impulsive, and, you know, here they are, they're, you know, I don't know, a chair of a Senate committee or something. And then this person is more impulsive, and look, well, they're on probation. You can really see that correlation. Now, if you look at the graph here, what we have is the average score is 64 for non-cocaine users, all right? And then for people who used a lot of cocaine at month one, T1, and then they decreased their use of cocaine over 12 months to T2, their impulsivity went down. They were still way above the non-users, but it went down. people who started off using some cocaine and ended up using more and more cocaine after over that period of a year, their impulsivity went up as measured by the scale. And then people who just kind of used the same amount of cocaine for 12 months, their impulsivity stayed high and it didn't really change. So that's one way to look at cognitive impairment, to measure it in people with addiction. Another way, this is kind of my favorite way here, this is the Iowa gambling task. And the way that this works, this is one of the most common psychological tests used to measure impulsivity in addiction. And it's four decks of cards, and your job is to pull cards off the deck, off of each one of these four decks, and try to make as much money as you can and stay out of debt. Now, you know, as in life, the cards are fixed, right? Just joking. But in the test, decks A and B give really big rewards right out of the gate, okay? Just like that big, massive dopamine rush, all right? And then, but pretty soon after you draw a couple, three cards, the returns diminish very quickly, and then you actually get into, you're losing money, all right? Now, decks C and D, they are like a certificate of deposit, right? Like they just pay slow, low, but steady returns over a long period of time. Now, if you give a test subject between 10 and 50 tries on these four decks, most non-addicts will very, very quickly, like, I mean, within 10 cards, they'll figure out, I really need to stick with deck C and D or I'm going to get in trouble here. All right, people are really good at figuring this out, unless you're an addict. And with addicts, what we see is lots of people, they'll take way more cards out of the A and B deck, even when it should become, I mean, it'll become clear to everybody else, this is a losing game. Those decks are losing decks, but they'll keep drawing off those losing decks. What good is that information? Well, for one thing, we can predict who is likely to do well in a rehab setting. Just by knowing how they score on that test, which is pretty interesting. If you graph shows subjects in a 6-week residential treatment facility for mixed substance use, so not any particular substance, but lots of different things. And then you can see the darker line is abstinent people, and they scored a lot higher on the test. And the people who relapsed scored a lot lower across the board. So we can tell that someone who does poorly on this test is more likely to relapse and drop out of treatment.
Yes, Senator Begich.
The graph causes me to ask a question. What do you ascribe the dip down in the equal response in week 3?
Yeah, so for Senator Begich through the chair. So good question. Basically, when you gather data points in any study, you're going to have what we call random variation in the results. And most likely, that dip would be attributable to random variation. There's always going to be some days that are warmer than others, some days that are rainier than others, some days that are windier than others, but they don't necessarily represent a pattern. And when researchers gather data like this and they put together a graph like this, they will sometimes look at data point, let's say data point 2 on top there, where you have a high that gets almost up to 4, and then it drops down at data point 3 down to 2. They will look at that and say, well, is that a statistically significant decrease? And what that refers to is using statistical techniques to find out if that really is a random variation or if that's, was there a terrible event on the news that everybody saw and that shook everybody up and made them do poorly on the test or what have you, okay? But a lot of times we look at graphs, you want to look at the general trend and not pay too much attention to the up-down. Unless the down is a trend or the up is a trend. Among methamphetamine users taking the IGT, the Iowa gambling task, you can see over on the left a control. What that means is that control group, that means people who were not addicted who took this test in this study, okay? And they scored pretty well. People who had used methamphetamine within 6 days, you can see that they did substantially worse than the control group. And the reason I put this here is because I talked earlier about how difficult it can be to reverse the brain changes that occur in addiction. If you look at this study that took place over 12 months, after 6 days, people are doing really poorly. They do a little bit better after 14 days of sobriety. They do a little bit better after a month and about the same after 3 months. After 6 months, minimum 6 months, we start to see scores improve to where they're comparable to the controls who were never addicted. Minimum 6 months, and then we really get out to 12 months before we see, you know, pretty close to a total recovery. So what this tells us is that it's not just that people who are more likely to become addicted start out impulsive. They do start out impulsive, but this kind of study, this particular study, but also this kind of study, tells us that drugs also make people even more impulsive than they were when they started. And it tells us that you can get some of that back, but you gotta wait for it. It takes a long time. And, you know, 30-day rehab program won't even get you back to where your impulsivity is, close to where the controls were, for example. And this is with methamphetamine, but same idea with any substance.
Senator Michicki.
So if I understand this correctly, if you can go back one slide, I think what you're saying, if I get this right, is that it affects all decision-making, and you're demonstrating that with the Iowa gambling task. It's not just a decision-making related to the drug of their addiction. It's decision-making across the board.
Yeah, so responding to Senator Mikish through the chair, so you've anticipated and actually almost quoted something on one of my later slides. So yes, it's a fundamental take-home point that the impulsiveness and just basically bad decision-making that happens in addiction, it generalizes. That's the word, is it generalizes to the rest of one's life.
Thank you, Senator Michicki, for the question.
Now I want to show you one really great slide on decision making in opioid users, and a couple of things to think about here. We don't really, it's 2017, and there have been lots and lots of studies done about lots and lots of things, and I think we all experience some frustration when we read the newspaper and a study comes out that tells us to do the opposite with our diet that we were told to do in the previous study that came out 6 months ago. For that reason, most experts don't look a lot at one study. We look at groups of studies that are carefully compared in a weighted average. And those studies are called meta-analyses. This is a slide from a meta-analysis of, I don't know how many different studies here, but about two-thirds of them are from current users of opioids. And the bottom third is for ex-users of opioids. And I want to emphasize that the average length of sobriety for the ex-users was about 3 years. So like a really respectably long time. Now, if you look at where all the dots are here, first of all, the zero line here right up the middle, if everybody in each one of these studies, if you had a black dot in each one of these studies on that line, it would mean there's no difference in decision making between people with opioid addiction and people without. But what you'll see is that almost all the studies are way over to the left on the side that favors controls. And again, controls are people who are not addicted to opioids. Over on the favors opioid users side, you have hardly anything. So actually, I love this slide for a number of reasons. One of them is that there are two outlier studies here, okay? And so there are two studies in this big group of studies that actually show that people who use opioids make better decisions than people who don't. Okay? Now, we know that's ridiculous. But this is illustrative of the fact that you get random variations even in well-designed studies. And you can never look at one study to tell you anything about what you should do. You've got to look at the meta-analysis. And in the meta-analysis, it's the white diamonds that give you the weighted average of all the studies together. And here's the weighted average of all the current users. And then here's the weighted average of all of the prior users. who have been sober on average for 3 years. And the other thing that I think is really fascinating about this slide is it shows that even after 3 years, you have very substantial decision-making deficits in opioid users. And it's really this that underscores the idea that opioid addiction is just more difficult to reverse those brain changes. I put on a slide about cannabis because cannabis is especially important right now. And I wanted to talk about computer modeling. Computer modeling can kind of get into the nuances and break down further the cognitive deficits that give rise to the test scores on tests like the Iowa gambling task. And here we have a control group on the Iowa gambling task. So that means people who are not regular users of cannabis. And then we have down here, we have regular cannabis users. And you can see that there's a pretty good difference, I mean, a very consistent difference in the scores. And when you run this through the computer modeling, what you come up with is that the reasons the cannabis users scored more poorly on these tests were the three that are listed. So they ignored loss magnitude. So on a deck of cards, it's, you know, you're pulling out of that deck A and deck B, and you're losing money now. I mean, you're into the losing money zone. And you can lose money on cards C and D too, but you lose more on A and B. Well, these subjects kept pulling cards off of A and B, even though the losses were much greater. And you can extrapolate that to everyday life, where it's like, you know, I missed a day at work because I was hungover. Eh, no big deal. I lost my job because I was hungover. Eh, no big deal. It's just kind of like, it's all the same. The user group was more influenced by recent gains, so they might have pulled 40 cards, and they know that decks A and B are going to give them big losses most of the time, and decks C and D are going to give them little gains most of the time. But they just pulled an A, and they won big. I mean, like the one arm, you know, the slot machine just seriously paid out, so they're going to take all that money and put it back into the slots again, you know, not realizing that that's not likely to happen over and over again. So, but a recent gain means a lot to these folks. They also made decisions that were less consistent with what they expected. So this is kind of like, you know, if you walk across the street with your eyes closed, you know you're likely to get hit by a car, but you do it anyway. It's kind of a silly example, but that's the idea. So you can kind of tease out the reasons why people do poorly on these tests with computer modeling. It's pretty interesting. All right. That takes us to imaging studies. So we've got three different perspectives so far on decision-making deficits in addiction, and then this is the fourth one. So most of you, I think, will have seen pictures like this before. What this picture shows on the top, this is not a single person's brain. It's a composite. It's a picture of perhaps 15 or 30 subjects, however many they put in the scanner, and you can see the, I think this is the orbital frontal cortex, which is part of or close to the prefrontal cortex. It's in that circuit. And the reddish-orange areas are where they put a radioactive dye that binds to dopamine receptors. All right? And you can see that in a control, which again, in medical parlance, means somebody who's not a drug user, they've got lots of nice, healthy, reddish-orange dopamine receptors there. And then when you look at a cocaine abuser, you don't see as much. In fact, you hardly see any of that reddish-orange. They've down-regulated their dopamine receptors. So you can see where just a normal, you know, again, I go back to the school play example, you know, just normal fun does not do it anymore when you are severely addicted to a substance. Even though this is a slide for cocaine use, you can find similar slides for just about any substance in some behaviors because the effects are almost the same. The lower picture there, again, these are composite images, and what they just show is the glucose metabolism. What does that mean? That means how much sugar is your brain burning right now. And you can see that this orbital frontal cortex, again, very active in a control, doing lots of thinking, reasoning, judgment, things that you need to do to be successful in life, and here in the cocaine abuser, you have substantially reduced metabolism. Not a big surprise. This is just a conceptual slide that it doesn't, the circles here don't correlate exactly to brain structures, but they correlate pretty well to what different brain structures do. And so in the center here, we have this drive. You can call it a drive to use. And in a healthy brain, you have lots of control up in your prefrontal cortex here. This is the parent exerting control with a big red arrow on the drive. You have the saliency of drugs, very small for the non-addict. You know, many non-addicts have tried alcohol, drugs, but they didn't get addicted, and so they know that that was cool, it felt good, but it's kind of dangerous, they're not going to do it again. The saliency is small. And the memory of it is, that was a good party, but, you know, I got to go to work today. So the drive is small, and they don't go use. In an addicted brain, by contrast, the controlling parent, the prefrontal cortex, conceptually is shrunken, and it's less effective. And so that red, big red arrow becomes kind of a second, weakened little arrow. The saliency of drugs, by contrast, is enormous. It's shouting at your prefrontal cortex, drugs, 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 all day long. The memory of how wonderful it felt the last time you used drugs, it's right there kind of shouting at the saliency, and the ultimate effect is that, you know, the drive increases and you go use. Talk a little bit about treatment. 12-step groups, peer support groups are not strictly treatment, but they are interventions that help a lot of people. That's all I'll say about that. Detoxification, there's lots of different forms of detox. We may talk a little bit about that later. Psychosocial treatment, I'm using that as an umbrella term to refer really to different intensities of counseling and psychotherapy. All right. They're very effective for most substance use disorders. Unfortunately, they're less effective for opioid use disorder. And then there's medication-assisted treatment. And in the opioid world, there's several categories, but let's not forget that in alcohol use disorder, we also have medication-assisted treatment that is actually pretty effective and kind of underutilized. Detox. Not really a treatment. If for those of you who are medical folks, you know debridement is cleaning a wound. And that's really what detox is. It's cleaning a wound to prepare it for surgical intervention or what have you, but it is not really treatment itself. It's usually medically supervised. It is mostly effective as a bridge to more definitive treatment, whether it's psychosocial treatment or other treatment. Mostly it's economic reasons and practical reasons why we need to detox people at all from opioids. We could take people who are addicted to opioids and move them right into medication-assisted treatment if we had infinite resources, but we don't. Usually there's a waiting list or the person's not eligible or what have you, and so then we need to detox. You need to know about detox from opioids that it is it doesn't do anything for your relapse rate. Relapse rates are really, really high, number one. And number two, within the month after detoxing from opioids, that's when your overdose risk is highest. And I'm talking about, you know, death by overdose. That's when your risk is highest. So for many addicts that I've seen in my practice, I have said, no, you're better off not detoxing. You're better off continuing to use until we can get you into the methadone clinic, because I don't want to set them up to die of an overdose. That's not for every person, but for some people. Kind of already said that. I think all of you are familiar with naloxone. I only raise this point just to make it clear that naloxone is a wonderful thing for reversing the respiratory arrest that comes with heroin overdose and sometimes overdose of other opioids. But as soon as that person comes back to life again, they are right where they started. This is not a treatment. It's just like if some of you may know what an AED is, an automatic electronic defibrillator. you can restart somebody's heart, but you don't stop there. You have to get them into treatment with a cardiologist, and it's the same idea with naloxone. Psychosocial treatment, very, very effective for many types of addiction. For some addictions, like cannabis use disorder, we don't have anything else but psychosocial treatments. Again, for alcohol, we have some medication-assisted treatments, but they are not the cornerstone of treatment. Psychosocial treatments and self-help groups are much more effective for alcohol use disorder for most people. I would argue that psychosocial treatment is essential as a component to medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. Unfortunately for me, there is an increasingly large number of studies that says that you don't really need that, that outcomes with medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder are really the same whether you give them counseling and psychotherapy or not. That's not something that makes me happy. I have a strong psychotherapy training and practice background, but that's what the studies say. What we do know definitively is that psychosocial treatment for opioid use disorder alone, as a standard, a standalone treatment, does not work. It just doesn't. Now, that's not to say that there are people it doesn't work for. There's always outliers. But on a population level, it's not effective. So I'll talk briefly about medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. It really falls into two categories, and then one of them falls into two subcategories. So there's methadone and buprenorphine, and their job is to replace opioids in the addict's brain and to normalize the imbalance of receptor densities that occur in the addict's brain. And not to make them feel high, but to make them feel normal. All right. Methadone is a full agonist, and the way it works is it has a really long half-life, so if you dose it correctly, it shouldn't make the person high. It occupies the receptor for a long time, but it is an opioid that opens the receptor all the way.
And Dr. Sunkis, I just want to let you know in your time, if you could go about another 10 minutes so we can have time for questions and
absolutely
for dialogue.
Yep. We're coming close to the end here. Buprenorphine, I think most of you are familiar with, also known as Suboxone, is a partial agonist. It is in some ways safer than methadone because it only opens the receptor part way, and it makes it much, much more difficult to overdose and die of respiratory arrest, even if you combine it with alcohol or benzodiazepines or another respiratory depressant. It's safer in that regard. And then on the right, we have naltrexone, which also comes in a long-acting injectable formulation. And what that does is it just blocks the receptor so that an opioid addict can't get high. Methadone. Full agonist, long life, administered only in specially licensed methadone clinics. Also, it can be used for pain treatment. That doesn't require a special clinic, but some doctors will prescribe it for pain. It works pretty well. Buprenorphine, like I said, it's harder to overdose. You can prescribe it in an office setting, but you need special training to be able to do that. You don't have to have federal oversight in a special clinic, but the prescriber needs to have special training. It's not very much. It's about 8 hours of continuing education, and most prescribers can pull it off in 4 hours, so it's not very much. Also used in pain treatment without any special training required. Talk about advantages of opioid replacement therapy. There's very, very consistent evidence to support efficacy. There's much better treatment retention. People stay in opioid replacement programs for years. You get far fewer overdose deaths because you're not detoxing people and taking away their tolerance. You're just keeping them at that steady level of opioids in their blood. Hospitalization rates go down, and consequently, costs go down. So it's cost effective. Disadvantages, there's a potential for abuse and diversion. Now, if you're going down to the methadone clinic, you're waiting in line, and somebody's handing you a pill, watching you swallow it, and then checking under your tongue afterwards to make sure you really did swallow it, not a lot of risk for diversion there. So there is less risk for diversion in a methadone clinic, although it does happen. With buprenorphine, it's prescribed in an office setting. Often people will take home a month's worth at a time, and we see much more diversion of buprenorphine than methadone for that reason. And in fact, when we do see methadone diversion, it's usually from pain clinics or usually from pain prescribers, not from methadone clinics per se. It's a lifelong treatment for many, whether it is buprenorphine or methadone. There's up to a 95% relapse rate within 12 months if you try to taper somebody off of methadone or buprenorphine, which is pretty high. It can be done for some people, and it's worth a try, but you really have to be careful because most people by far will relapse excuse me, within a short period of time. And then a lot of people, this is kind of maybe the biggest disadvantage, is a lot of people see opioid replacement therapy as substituting one addiction for another. So there's a big kind of a stigma to overcome there. Antagonist treatment is, again, long-acting. We're talking about long-acting injectable naltrexone, otherwise known as Vivitrol. Very popular in policy circles. Advantages include it blocks the high from opioids. So if you're on naltrexone, long-acting injectable naltrexone, you are not going to go spend money on heroin because you know it's not going to get you high. So you're just not going to do it. It avoids the stigma of opioid replacement therapy. It doesn't replace one addiction with another. It's a totally different medication. It's a totally different drug. It blocks the receptor that the drug of abuse uses to get you high. It appeals to people who favor abstinence, and it can't be abused or diverted because it doesn't do anything. Doesn't do anything pleasurable. Disadvantages, first of all, if you're going to do naltrexone, the research is definitive on this. There's no point using the oral. It won't work. It's no better than giving a sugar pill. If you're going to do it, you've got to give the injection. If you have a doctor who's on a consent agreement with the medical board and has to give a urine test or a hair sample on a very frequent basis, and has a huge hammer of losing their medical license hanging over their head, tends to have pretty good treatment retention. In every other population that's been studied so far, which is not very many, retention in treatment is very low. It's on average 7.5 or 8 weeks. And the reason is that naltrexone blocks the high, so you're not going to go spend the money and get high, and that's a good thing. But it doesn't take away your craving, and it doesn't make you feel normal. There's one thing I really want to make sure that everyone hears is that addicts, when they're sober, they don't feel normal. They feel normal when they're using. And the whole idea of opioid replacement is to make them feel normal by normalizing that ratio between the receptors and the opioids. And naltrexone does not do that, and so consequently what you have, if you're not a physician on a consent agreement or sometimes, you know, a felon on parole, you just drop out of treatment after 8 weeks and then you go relapse. The other thing is that if you break your leg on naltrexone, your emergency physician is going to have a really hard time treating your leg pain. There's been one economic study that I know of in Medicaid populations that was in Vermont, and it was just, I think, towards the end. Oh, this is there's a bunch of studies on the cost effectiveness. I'm jumping ahead. But this study in Vermont in a Medicaid population came out just toward the end of last year, and it reduced hospital admissions, emergency department visits, for Medicaid beneficiaries with opioid addiction compared with psychosocial treatments, abstinence, or detox. So what that means is that they gave one group psychosocial treatment, abstinence, and or detox, and that group kept going into the hospital, kept going into the ER, kept getting admitted, whereas the medication-assisted treatment group did not. So it was a cost-effective intervention for Vermont, and I think we'll see more studies like this come out in the next couple of years. Just to recap very, very briefly, addiction is a learning disorder with biological, psychological, and social components. Again, I'm not claiming supremacy of a medical model, but it's an important perspective, and it gives us an avenue to treatment that actually works. Historically, biology has taken a back seat in public policy for managing opioid use disorder. We've known for 40 years that opioid replacement therapy works the best, and I'm not working for anybody that's, you know, a clinic that's prescribing opioid replacement therapy. So That's my own professional opinion based on published peer-reviewed research. The science of opioid use disorder points to biology as a key component in managing the opioid epidemic. Most people with opioid use disorder cannot just quit. So I would suggest that as policymakers and policy advisors, we all manage OUD accordingly. And that's it.
All right. We'll open up to questions. Rep. Johnson.
You might have mentioned this, but it's my understanding that unlike alcohol addiction, with opioid addiction, you can't die from withdrawal. Is that correct? From detox? The act of being taken off the opioid.
So answering through the chair, in general, alcohol withdrawal is much more dangerous and you're much more likely to die from it than opioid withdrawal. But for people who are elderly, frail, have comorbid, what we call comorbid, so concurrently existing medical conditions like diabetes or seizure disorder or high blood pressure or any of a host of other illnesses, the severity of opioid withdrawal can exacerbate another illness enough to result in mortality pretty easily. So, okay. For example, in our corrections population, opioid withdrawal kills. It does happen. So you can't, there's no argument that alcohol withdrawal is far more dangerous than opioid withdrawal, but you can't draw a clear line and say that opioid withdrawal is safe.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, your presentation was very interesting, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I learned a great deal. I think the question now that we have in front of us, I think as a whole legislative body, is what now in terms of programs, funding mechanisms, addressing this issue in our state? And some of the questions that I have is, have there been like a scan of what kind of programs we have in our state right now? Are they working in silos? Are they competing for the same funding sources? And then the last question, so it's a big loaded one here, is do we have specific targeted programs that focus on specific populations around the state, such as maybe incarcerated inmates or things of that nature?
Well, answering through the chair, that was a complex question. I'll try to address the first part of it. I don't know whether there's been a study of what treatments are available and for what populations. What I know from my practice and from the practices of physicians and others that I supervise is that it's very, very difficult to get people into chemical dependency treatment. And it doesn't matter whether it's alcohol or methamphetamine or cocaine or opioids. It's just very, very difficult. And in particular, it's very, very difficult to get someone into medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. There are long waiting lists. It's difficult to qualify someone to get into treatment. They have to have a special assessment that costs them $150, and they often don't have it, or they're going to go out and spend that money on using before they ever come and see the person for the special assessment. So there are lots of hurdles for patients to overcome that they look like perfectly reasonable things to ask someone to do until you look closely at the way that those people that you're asking to do it actually think and behave. It just becomes too much for them. And that's before we even get to the question about payer sources, which I don't know whether there's competition for the same payer sources. I don't know how there wouldn't be, though. And historically across the country, abstinence-based opioid use programs have had kind of a hegemony for 40 years, even though during all that time we've known that they don't really work very well. It was 2014, there was rehabs were a $35 billion a year industry. And that's a lot of money for programs that have a 70% relapse rate at best and an even worse relapse rate for opioid use disorder. So there certainly is competition for funding streams out there. What that looks like specifically in Alaska, I don't know.
Thank you.
I have a question, Dr. Sunkiss. So during your presentation, you may mention that we have a pretty high relapse rate with opiate use, and generally it's high with some other substances. Currently, the way some of our programs work throughout many departments of the state is that there's a given choice for a client or a user to seek help without receiving some other high consequence. And once they relapse, the consequence is thus given, which is pretty great as far as that. How would you recommend that we sort of look at some of the relapse as a consequence in dealing with some of our state agencies as policies? Or, and I'm not asking you to draft the policy or not, but I mean, because that's pretty much the issue. I mean, we have that with, and I don't want to start naming the programs, but we have pretty high within the court system and through other departments of this problem.
Right, so in general, I'm glad I don't have to write the policy, because behavioral principles are very, very difficult to incorporate into policy. In general, people's behavior, whether they're addicts or not, is much more effectively influenced with rewards than with punishments. So when we work with addicts, it's almost always in the context of, if you don't do this, you know, we're going to do something bad to you, which makes perfect sense. But if there's any way to reward abstinence as opposed to punishing relapse, that is likely to be more effective, just on the basis of basic behavioral principles and what works in all behavioral modification across the board. I think specifically with opioid use disorder, this is a population that is, if you remember back to the slide with the cognitive impairment, this is a population that is very, very resistant to feeling bad about punishments. It's a population that just isn't going to respond to punishment the way that you or I would. And leaving aside those behavioral principles, what the research says is that the best way to get those people sober and keep them sober is with medication-assisted treatment. And instead of waiting until they fail their third 30-day rehab, what you would want to do is you would want to have that person assessed for the severity of their addiction, and then depending on the outcome of that assessment, get them into opioid replacement therapy earlier rather than later. And there is a tendency toward fail-first policies in the insurance industry and in regulation as well, where we want to see people, you know, we're going to send you to rehab first, and if you fail that, then we'll think about the opioid replacement. That's actually the exact opposite of the way that the rest of medicine works. The rest of medicine will prescribe first-line treatment first, and then if that doesn't work, then we go to second-line treatment. But in addiction, we do the opposite. We prescribe second-line treatment first because it's cheaper. It's cheaper this quarter. But over the life of the person and the person's addiction, it becomes much more expensive.
Thank you. Senator Begich and Senator Giesel.
I want to sort of build off what you just said. You talked about responding to behavior modification and behavior processes. When I was working with the juvenile justice system, one thing we noticed was a significantly increased population suffering from alcohol-related birth defects, which absolutely wipes out the ability to respond to behavioral modification or efforts at correcting an antisocial or bad behavior. Wouldn't the same thing apply here, that precisely what you just said would apply to a substantial number of our population, because they already come in with an inability to be impacted by behavioral health decisions, not just because of the addiction, but possibly prior to the addiction?
Yeah, so through the chair, I would be cautious about characterizing any population or any person as, you know, being never able to respond to or benefit from a treatment, particularly with, you know, children and adolescents with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. It is true that that population is kind of notoriously struggle with learning from their experiences. But that doesn't mean that they can't. What it means is that we need to start our interventions early, and we need to be extremely consistent and extremely patient about applying them. And in an adult addiction world, of course, no person is as simple as a study, and every person carries some trauma with them, and they may have gestational neurotoxin exposures. We don't know. I think we have to, as a clinician, I have to take every patient as he or she comes to me, and at a population level, at a policy level, I think we're going to have to be patient. There's no fast fix for any of this. But I would definitely stop short of saying that this is a population that cannot learn.
I appreciate that very much. A very quick follow-up?
I'm going to continue. We have lots of questions, Dr. Sunquist. Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Dr. Sunquist. So a couple of years ago, the people of Alaska voted to legalize recreational marijuana. And my concern at the time, and I still hold the concern, is that our youth are going to be more and more readily exposed. I don't deny that they were exposed prior to this. Do you view that? Do you have concern about that? Do you think we're going to see more addiction because of the youthful brain being affected, the prefrontal cortex being affected with exposure to marijuana? Is it more impactful at younger ages?
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, I think I'll be much better prepared to answer that question in about 20 years. What we know now is that from the time you're born until the time you're about 13, your brain is growing and creating more neural connections, more synapses, more connections between brain cells. And then at the age of 13, give or take, you reach a point where the signal-to-noise ratio is not optimal for optimal adult functioning, if you will. And if you think about 13-year-olds that you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And so what happens around the age of 13 is that your brain begins to prune those neural connections, to disconnect them so that it improves the signal-to-noise ratio and emotionality and impulsivity and other cognitive and behavioral issues that are normal for a 13-year-old but wouldn't be normal for a 33-year-old. They rectify themselves. Okay. Now, with marijuana, we know cannabinoids interfere with the neural pruning process. And so we will see in children and adolescents who use cannabis that their brains do not mature and they don't prune the way that they should, and then they carry 13-year-old cognitive deficits into adulthood. And there's some potential for associated loss of IQ and other measurable deficits. So at the level of the individual user, just looking at the cannabis, I would strongly encourage parents, even parents who use cannabis, that doesn't mean that you have to let your kids use it. It's not safe for kids to use, and it's not a good idea. As far as, is it a gateway drug? Is it going to mean that we're going to have an explosion of addiction to other drugs over the next 20 years? I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that question. I certainly don't, I'm afraid.
Chair Sponholz and Senator Machicki.
Thank you, through the chair, Dr. Sunquist. I have two questions that are separate. So one of them is you were mentioning. So I want to contextualize this with saying I'm really excited to be having a conversation about sort of what does the evidence say about treating addiction, rather than what does sort of our tradition say about treating addiction? Because I think traditions aren't always right. Sometimes we learn new things, and I know that we've learned a lot about brain science in particular in the last 10 to 15 years. You mentioned that medical-assisted treatment is the most effective treatment as it relates to opioids. My question is it the same with alcohol? And then I have a second question. You mentioned that positive reinforcements are the most effective behavior modification techniques, and even with a child on the fetal alcohol spectrum, I can attest that's been true in my experience. Can you give an example of what a positive reinforcement might be for somebody who maybe is already sucked into the criminal justice system in order to participate and be a success in treatment?
Okay, sure. So the first question, through the chair, I think the first question is medication-assisted treatment kind of the cornerstone of treatment for alcohol use disorder as it is with opioid use disorder. First of all, I will agree that medication-assisted treatment is, in fact, the cornerstone of treatment for opioid use disorder, at least once you've gotten to the point of using IV. And once you've gotten to the point of using IV, I would say don't waste time with any treatment program that doesn't involve medication-assisted treatment. Now, by contrast, alcohol use disorder has some really good medications that can help, but they are not effective enough to form the cornerstone of treatment. The cornerstone of treatment is still peer support groups and psychosocial interventions like alcohol counseling, and more intensive counseling and psychotherapeutic approaches.
Okay. And then the second one was the positive reinforcement. And
the second one was to come up with an example of a positive reinforcer for someone who is involved in the criminal justice system. Usually an increase in privileges, at least a temporary one, a temporary time-limited increase in privileges is a really good approach to reward. Now, there have been a lot of studies, primarily with methamphetamine and other stimulants, where people get a monetary reward. And I think most of us kind of wince when we hear that. Mm-hmm. The results in the studies are actually pretty spectacular, and the monetary rewards are small. It's like a chance to win $10 in a drawing from a hat. It's like that kind of, it's not a very big reward. But nobody wants to pay someone to stay sober. It's just contrary to, I think, the way most of us see the world. So I would suggest looking at ways to increase privileges. And it's maybe a little harder with probation. With OCS, it's actually really easy because it means you get more visits. You know, and you don't, it's not, what I would suggest is thinking about, it's not a step up in privileges, it's just a brief step up and then a step back down until you can show me again that you can toe the line.
And I understand that some of us may have to other appointments, but if it's all right with the committee to just go on a little bit longer with questions. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Zonkis, I have hundreds of questions, so I'm not going to do that. But with you know, we passed Senate Bill 91, the impacts of drug related crime in our communities throughout Alaska has reached an unmanageable level. I'm actually looking for a resource so I don't have to take up everyone's time today about. And perhaps that's probably the most difficult question I can ask you, but can you present us with a reading list, perhaps through the chair or directly to members, that we can cover as legislators to be better versed on opioid use and just addiction, to help us with our decision making here going forward?
Sure. I might have some reading here. The first one is actually, it's kind of an easy read, and it's a real classic on the neurobiology of opioid use disorders, and it kind of covers a lot of what I covered today. It doesn't get into what to do with a correctional population. That is a really, really sticky wicket that, I'm not familiar with a lot of the research in that area. But I will certainly take a look around and see what I can find, and I can forward it to the committee.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Sunkis? Well, Doctor, I want to thank you for coming. I know this is something that both I and Rep. Sponholz wanted to put on our agendas this session as we come up and try to address some of these things and making policies or looking to deal with this problem within our state. You know, one of the biggest things I got outside of this is that when making policies, we should all look at the sort of meta-analysis of lots of studies, not just one study of this. So I thank you. And I just want to remind the committee that we do plan to take up sort of the opioid task force presentation and look at other ways of issues and what they've found or would like to address to the committee, as well as some of the law enforcement aspects. And maybe later on, as we start going into this, as a member in the audience, we can start talking about some of the ways to deal with this in the Department of Corrections as well, as a population. So thank you guys again, and we will adjourn at 3:04.